It's now my pleasure to introduce Dana Fogerson, who is the Executive Director of REACH, which is Regina Education and Action on Child Hunger. Dana Fogerson is originally from North Battleford, where she was born and raised. She has been the Executive Director of REACH since 2008. Currently, she is also the co-chair of Food Regina and Food Secure Saskatchewan, both volunteer organizations. Her extensive career has included working in municipal government, healthcare, nonprofit organizations, private business, and provincial government. While working in these various areas, her experience includes community and social development, food security development, facility operations, sport, culture, recreation, volunteer developing, fundraising, nonprofit governance and public participation, policy research and development, and human and financial resource management. I stumbled on that because that's such a long list. Do you have a life aside from that? My goodness. The majority of Dana's food security experience has been urban-based and has also included work on poverty and child hunger. Throughout Dana's career, food security for children, families, and seniors has always been a priority, and she continues to work to improve the lives for all Saskatchewan residents. My goodness. Welcome, Dana.
So people always sort of say, yeah, I've been around. I've always lived in Canada. I started off in Saskatchewan, went to Alberta in the 70s when many people left the province. I kept going, ended up in Ottawa, came back to Saskatchewan. Fortunately, I have three sons. They were able to grow up in either Saskatoon or Regina. Two of them in Saskatoon, and the third one ended up growing up here in Regina. So I grew up in a family that did believe spiritually. I had a mother who was Baptist and a father who was Catholic and a grandmother who was Methodist. So quite a combination. They were also, one was an NDP, one was a conservative, and one was a liberal. So we grew up knowing sort of all the sides and all the bases, but we're always encouraged to make our own decisions. Volunteering and being involved in the community was also, I grew up in that. My parents volunteered. My father was very involved in sports. My mother was very involved in mental health and social issues. And there wasn't anything that they didn't do, that they didn't take us. So as very young children, we were already volunteering and being involved in the community. We just grew up with it. So people have often asked why my sons do what they do. And very much my sons are in their late 20s and early 30s, and they coach, they're involved in all sorts of different things in their community because my father, my parents, and then my husband and I, we emulated that. Our kids were involved in everything that we did. When we volunteered, they came along. Every time I had a new job or a new volunteer experience, my sons would roll their eyes like, oh, what she got us into. They knew that, you know, they were coming along, but it's really paid off. Like, they're very socially conscious, probably more so than even my husband and I were, probably more like their grandparents in all the various social issues. And so it's very exciting. And when I talk to people, that's how we can keep that going and have that. We really need to involve our kids or as grandparents, you know, our grandchildren. And so I really do believe there's a hope for the world, and it is in the next generations, and it's wonderful. So now I'm going to talk about food security, and I'll just sort of go over what I'm going to try and do here. I'm going to try and cover all of these aspects. I'm very passionate about what I'm doing now in my career. This is my retirement job, working at REACH. What it is, it's a culmination of all those other things that you heard that I did. I didn't choose to necessarily be in all those areas. I have a husband who's in the computer business, who we traveled all over the country because of that. So everywhere I went, I was able to work, but I found different things. But everything that I did sort of built to the skills that I have for the position that I'm in now. So that's kind of how I got to where I got. I'm going to talk a little bit about the community food assessment. I actually recognize some faces here. I never know where I know you from because we're involved at REACH. Last year, we were involved with 155 other organizations and groups and schools to deliver all our programs. So I do quite a bit of public speaking, and some of you could, you know, be at those organizations and that kind of stuff. So I never know quite where I interact with people. Sometimes I'm multiple. You know, I know Jim from the radio. I know Jim from Amnesty. You know, different things like that. So usually the people I'm talking to often know a lot about this, but maybe just don't know the whole picture. 2 years ago, we embarked on a community food assessment. It was kind of about the same time that the City of Regina was doing the Design Regina, and they were doing public input sessions also. So we were able to meet with close to 500 individuals who came to our public meetings, but we also knew that a lot of the individuals and families that we work with would never go to a public meeting. So we had 45 focus groups of clients of some of our partners, of people who use our programs, to also get their input on what the issues were around food security. It was a very collaborative project. One of our first steps was the environmental scan. We had a partnership with the U of R and the First Nations University, so they did an environmental scan to see what was out there and what we found in that environmental scan. And if you go on the Food Regina website, you can have a look at it. We found out there were more gaps than there were things. So we learned that we needed to do more research. And so we're working with both universities to look at some of those gaps. I talked about the community consultants, consultations and the focus groups. And then after that, we did a prioritization to look at what our action plans were and to develop an action plan. These were the four priorities that we were told from the public and our groups. It wasn't, there are some other things. The research piece, certainly the public didn't tell us that we needed to do more research, but we knew from the environmental scan that we needed to do that, and that is ongoing. But one of the things was to talk about an improved infrastructure for local food production and distribution, to improve education and awareness. I think everybody knows about REACH and what REACH does. Well, they don't. And not just that. Things like community gardens, we heard over and over and over, if you're new to the city, you don't know how to access it. There's no sort of master plan or a master list anywhere. There's a number of lists, and if you're not in the know, you don't know how to access those. Seems simple, but for somebody that's really concerned about gardening, it's not. They wanted to see pilot projects. They wanted people to just try things and then to advocate for policy change. So this is what we are, a network. Food Regina is a network. It's farmers, business people, the farmers market, it's REACH, it's Food Bank, it's RQHR. So it's a group of mostly people working in the field. We do have a couple of chefs that are on this overseeing network. So we had to say, okay, we have to look at these issues. What can we do in a year or 2 years? Not saying that all the information that we gathered we won't be using, but we can only do so much in every year, and we keep going back to that. So one was a communications plan. So we have worked with a communications specialist to develop our website better so that we can, oh, there's the water, so that people can go to that website and connect to various things. eThink Vote, we were one of the first public all candidates forums to talk about food and food security in a national food policy. And I'm very proud to say that we had every candidate except that one party that didn't attend, most of them. But we had every other candidate in Regina who attended that. I think there is hope for the world. The thing that I personally saw at that, we had 130 people who came out to that, plus the candidates. The one thing that I saw, and maybe it was because we were one of the first, if not the first, public forum, was it was neat to see the candidates talk to each other and share ideas, and really, they had some really neat conversations on the sides that said to me that, you know, maybe there's hope, they can work together. As I say, but one party was missing, but all the rest were really willing to talk to each other and to talk about some of these issues. We are developing a master plan for community gardens, and we actually have a nutrition student with RQHR that's trying to put a master plan together for Regina, and so that you can go to our website and it would list all of the community gardens in the city and who's contact person. It seems like such a simple thing, but we heard it over and over and over and over in our public input that people just didn't know how to do that. On the website for Food Regina, and just Google Food Regina and you'll see it, we have the full action plan and the full input that we heard. So if anybody was at those, please don't think that we aren't going to take action on what we heard. We can only do so much at a time. Another thing that we were involved in the last couple of years was some seniors research. Both the Food Bank and REACH have seen a huge increase in seniors accessing our services. And the Food Bank access is even more disturbing than seniors accessing our programs. Because the Food Bank is emergency food, whereas with REACH, and I'll talk about our programs, it's slightly different. It's for low income, and it's also for any seniors, one of our programs. So the Food Bank was really disturbing for us. So we partnered with the UR, with RQHR, the Food Bank, and REACH. And what this was, this research involved actually interviewing 25 seniors. It wasn't huge, but 25 seniors who actually access either REACH or the Food Bank. They did three interviews with them, two with most, but three with some. Each interview was from an hour to an hour and a half to kind of get a feel for their situation, but also how they're getting food. And this is when I started, after this, was what they call Dana's Roadshow. But I've been talking to a lot of churches because we did find out some things, some good things that churches were doing that I don't think they realized. And I'll talk about that when we get down a little further. So I don't think it's any surprise that seniors accessing the Food Bank, one of the biggest things was income. And of course, low income, being lower than the poverty line. And of course, women being much more vulnerable than men because of not, you know, working outside of the home, maybe as long or not at all. There's still that generation that probably didn't. The other thing that we found was community supports and resources. A lot of seniors didn't know what other, they knew the Food Bank, but they didn't know about what other community supports and resources there were. So hence, we've been doing a lot more public speaking at a lot of more seniors organizations and that kind of stuff to let them know. This was what we found, that seniors were really resilient and very creative. And this is where the churches came in. We heard from many seniors that they were volunteering at church events that involved food So they may be helping with the church suppers. A lot of different churches do lunch after the service. They were helping at that, so then they would partake in that. And then if there were leftovers, they would take those home. They would never tell the parish, and will never tell them, I'm sure, that they were hungry. But they were very involved in all of those food-related types of events within the church. So as a heads up, what we've been saying to many churches, keep doing it, because those people aren't going to tell you. We were amazed that they did tell these young university students who were interviewing them, but you know, they knew that was in total confidentiality, and it wouldn't be told back. But I think it's very important that the churches realize that. And in a lot of cases, you're doing it to build community and to build that social aspect, which are also very important. But you may well be meeting a nutrition and dietary need. Accessibility of food, big one. And I'll talk about that part in some of the programs that we do. It's difficult for seniors to get out and get food, and that there may be a place that churches, again, can play a role in assisting with that, getting people out to be able to get their groceries, or to, in the winter, going for groceries for individuals. And transportation builds into that. And then, of course, mental health. And which comes first, it's hard to say. One of the big things that we found in this study was most of those individuals who were accessing the food bank had no family in Regina, and maybe didn't have any family at all. They were solely, so they also usually really suffered from isolation and depression, but you know, which came first is hard to say. So these were key components in understanding what was happening at the food bank and at Reach. I'm going to talk about our programs now. Reach stands for Regina Education and Action on Child Hunger. So why do we work with seniors? Well, one of the things that we found out at Reach many years ago was just feeding kids, and that's what we started off as an umbrella organization to help support breakfast and lunch programs in the city. And to this day, we still support 18 other schools and organizations to do breakfast and lunches. And I'll talk about that a little bit more. But this is the key. This is what makes Reach work. We have, as I said, 155 partners. We work with over 200 volunteers a week, and that's how we can do what we do. We don't do anything on our own, nor do we plan to, because it's all about partnerships, and always has been. Our structure has been to work with others and to support what's there. We currently have 6 full-time staff and 4 part-time staff. Child nutrition, as I mentioned to you last year, we had 18 partner organizations. We fed over 7,000 children between the ages of 0 and 18 at 45 different locations, over 450,000 meals. That's a stat that I'm not particularly proud of. I don't think we should have to do any of that. Like, we live in a rich country. It's a sad state of affairs that even needs to happen. Along with the child nutrition program, Reach is 26 years old also, just so that you know, we're in our 26th year. We also have what's called a buying co-op. And any of our partners who we partner with can buy under our umbrella from our suppliers. We do all the paperwork, and we actually pay the bill up front, and then we do all the individual billing, and that's how we've been able to sort of broker this with our partners. So then they're able to take their food dollars and leverage it to buy more healthier food and get more food. So we work with some of the women's shelters, the schools, the breakfast and lunch programs. There's a variety of groups that buy under that. And we buy $1 million worth of food a year, so we have some negotiating power with our suppliers. So And of that food, and I'll talk about it a little bit too, we don't give our food away except in the child nutrition programs. All of our programs, people pay for. We call them customers. We don't call them clients. They're customers. They buy the food. But all the overhead is what we do through our fundraising and our donations, so our staff salaries, all of that. But they're actually paying for the actual cost of the food, not all those other costs that go with it, but they're paying for the food. It's not given away. The food that we buy is bought directly from the suppliers, and then it comes in that morning, it's packed, and it goes out that afternoon. So it's not, there isn't even a real shelf life like in the store. All of REACH's programs are designed to break down the barriers of cost and transportation. So, and as I'll talk about each one. And it's all meant to provide nutritious meals for individuals and families. This, once we realized that just feeding kids wasn't going to get at child hunger, the first program that we came up, and this is a best practice in North America. It's called the Good Food Box. Some of you may be familiar with it. We have 45 locations around Regina that are Good Food Box locations, and we actually work with 6 of the First Nations reserves around Regina. We don't deliver to them, but they come in and pick up the boxes. So it's fresh fruits and vegetables, and there are some other, you can buy a breakfast box now, and there's some other things that you can get. Concept being that we would be in your neighborhood. We aren't in every neighborhood, but we are in a lot of the neighborhoods. And many are schools, so you can just walk to that location and get a good food box. About 12 years ago, social services came to us and wondered if there was a program that we could design that would involve delivery, because transportation being such an issue. So we have developed a program called the Family Basket, and it's the only program we have. You have to be on social assistance. And I tell people it's a program that they choose. Individuals choose to do that. So what happens is they buy for $30, they get 50 pounds of food, and they can have it delivered to their door. If they're able to, we have 4 depots. If they're able to actually go to that location, they can actually get meat with it in lieu of the delivery. For 13 years, we've had a partnership with Street Culture Youth. They were our delivery drivers. Unfortunately, as of this month, they can no longer deliver for us. So we have been very fortunate. Somebody up there is looking after us. We've just struck a partnership with the Abilities Council, and they'll be doing our delivery as of November 1st. So again, everything's a partnership. What the delivery drivers are individuals who are being trained as delivery drivers. So it's also an employment program. We pay, not what we'd probably pay a regular courier, but we pay per delivery, and it's a win-win for the other organization and for us. With the Family Basket, I always explain to people, they say, well, that individual's on social assistance, so what's the big deal? Well, the big deal is first they're making a choice. So if you're a good budgeter and it comes off of your check, because it comes directly off the check and they send us the money. So if you're a good budgeter, well, it's taken care of and you look after it. If you're a bad budgeter, it even makes more sense because you don't have to worry about it. If you live in a situation where there are drugs or alcohol or issues like that, you're seeing clear enough to ensure that you have food on the table for your kids. So there's a lot, and there's a lot of more complicated, the individuals that we work with on that program, they have complicated lives, but they are making a good choice in buying that basket. It is about 30%, both the Good Food Box and the Family Basket, probably about 30% less than what you would pay in the grocery store. So their food dollar, they are leveraging it to go a lot further. We have mobile stores. Again, I live in Hillsdale. And I don't know if many of you live in this neighborhood, but we actually have grocery stores in our neighborhood. I have a multiple of grocery stores. I live on Proctor. My corner store is the co-op store. I can walk across the street to, well, it's not called Loblaws anymore, but to Loblaws. I go down the street, there's Sobeys. Most of the people that are involved in our mobile stores live in neighborhoods that don't have grocery stores anymore, and they don't have cars, and there's all sorts of issues. So we're in actually in 10 locations. We have a partnership with Regina Housing. We're in 5 low-income senior high-rises. We go in once a week. We bring in fresh fruits and vegetables and dairy and all sorts of things. And then we're 5 neighborhood mobile stores. Again, we're trying to break down cost as a barrier, but also transportation as a barrier. We have 2 in North Central, 1 at Albert Scott Community Center and 1 at Rainbow Youth. We have 1 in Eastview Community Center. We have 1 downtown at the YWCA. And we have 1 at the Regina Senior Citizen Center. That's not a senior store, that's for the neighborhood. Another program that we have is called the Convenience Meal Program. This one is predominantly for seniors, although anybody can buy it. So we have, you know, individuals who buy these meals for somebody, say, that's on chemo or somebody's had surgery and they can't cook. All sorts of reasons. We deal with sons and daughters and grandchildren all over the world who are buying these meals and ensuring that grandparents or parents are getting them on a regular basis. This is a frozen meal, but along with it, and I have some information at the back, you can order fresh fruits and vegetables, you can order dairy, you can order eggs, bread, and then again, it's delivered to the door. Lo and behold, and it's sometimes hard for most of the people in this room's generation to understand it, but so we're providing food, we're breaking down the barriers of access and cost, transportation, but people don't know how to cook anymore. So one of the things that we do is we work with daycares in the inner city and try to promote here they're doing gardening, but also how to make healthy snacks. And because we know the earlier we get at them, the better it works, but also that these kids actually can influence their parents to better eat and to buy better groceries. And we have all kinds of stories of preschool kids, you know, wanting strawberries instead of candy and stuff like that. So it works. It really does. Just some stats that from a presentation I was at, just to show you that 1 in 4 children in Regina under 6 are living in households below the LICO. So, and that's approximately that. That's just the kids under 6. One of the things that we also try to do is make healthy eating fun. On Friday, I don't know if you heard anything, but on Friday we had over 6,000 kids at 22 schools around Regina. It was in recognition of World Food Day, called the Big Crunch, bite down on carrots. Almost 18,000 pounds of local carrots United Way bought for us for all of these schools so that the kids could have some fun, but also to have the discussion about eating healthy and buying local or growing your own, the whole aspect of that. We teach after-school cooking classes, and this is actually an awesome program, grades 4s and 5s throughout the low-income areas of the city. These kids, and you can see there's some boys there, right? Actually, most of our classes are about 50-50. Boys like to eat, and so they're really attracted to, because they get to cook lots of neat things and they get to eat them. One of the things that I like to talk to people, and again, I know you're the converted, but in the sense of family and how important family is and how important eating together is, many of the individuals that we work with can't relate to this. They've never sat down for a family meal. Parents haven't, and the kids haven't. So I've always talked about it, but I never had a term for it. And I was at a session just a few weeks ago, and Greg Inyon, the Director of Education for the Public Schools, used this. And I thought, oh, that's what I talk about. So I put this slide in. But family privilege and that whole concept, I talked about it at the start. You know, how did I end up doing what I did? Well, it was because of my family. It was just the right thing to do, or just the thing you do. I never thought about it being right or wrong. That was just the way I was brought up because I had those examples. Well, the individuals and the families that we work with don't really have that. And that's why it is hard, and we try to find ways to, especially with the kids, to start emulating some of those kind of practices. So he talks about this, John Sita talks about family privilege as being an invisible package of assets and pathways that provide us with a sense of belonging, safety, unconditional love, and spiritual values. With family privilege, children observe parents or older siblings to see the effort it takes to be successful in life. Family privilege provides the chance to hope and dream. And many of the individual children that we work with don't necessarily have that, but, you know, maybe there is an adult in their life who can provide that. And so that's part of the challenge of the individuals that we're working with. So we do a lot of parent and child. We're involved with many of the daycares, also with the early learning centers that are around the city now, and where we cook with parents and children. We have a meal with them. Again, sort of that emulating, showing how you can do that. We do a lot of adult cooking programs and more with newcomers to Regina, but we work with all kinds of groups. And again, many of it's, in this case, it's learning to make sandwiches actually for their kids for school using a lot of our ingredients that they would see in the grocery store or in the good food boxes because that's what they wanted to learn to cook with. Every program, we have sort of a core of our programs, but every group we work with, we design the program to fit that group. So it's all, every group is a little bit different. Community kitchens, we do a lot of community kitchens. We also train community kitchens or collective kitchens, you may either terminology, is where a group of people get together, buy in bulk, and then they cook in bulk, and they take the meals home for the week. So we really try to work with a lot of low-income partners to assist with this. So what can you do? Well, you can always volunteer for us. But there's a lot of different things. And when I've talked to a lot of different churches and stuff lately, is one of the movements across Canada is for churches to turn their nice green lawns into gardens, to open up their space once, because it costs a lot of money to have that nice green lawn. And so it can save money for the church, but also to open it up to the community as a garden. So that's one of the ideas if you're looking at expenses. And I don't know how much you don't have much land around here, so you're lucky. But lots of the churches that I talk to have huge, huge lawns, and it costs a lot of money to keep that going. So there's two or three right now that are really looking for it and doing that in the spring. But also is just being aware. Just being aware. We do have a number of churches that have or organizations that have, you know, a staff person around a bit who are good food box locations. So they don't just do it for their parish. They do it for the neighborhood around them. We have a partnership with St. James Anglican Church that they allow us to use their kitchen. They're in Rosemont, so it's a good location for us for that area. So they allow us to use that church, and they actually, some of their parishioners are volunteers in some of our programs that are in that church. We don't have a kitchen, nor do we want to have a kitchen. We recognize that we need to go to those locations where those programs, those individuals live and run those programs. Provincially and nationally, talk to your MLAs and your MPs about the importance of, you know, food security and understanding that we have these issues, and that I was involved a few years ago when the rapporteur came to Canada from the United Nations and said we had an issue in Canada with food security and hunger, and our government said, no, we don't. Like, we don't. We're not talking about it. It's not an issue, that kind of thing. It is. I mean, we have all the stats and stuff. So we just need to talk about it and let people know about it and keep talking about it till we do something about it. The other is, and we're a long ways from it, but a national lunch program for two reasons, and I'm not advocating for a free national lunch program, but we're one of two countries, industrial countries in the world, that doesn't have a national lunch program for school-aged children. We'd have a couple of advantages if we could ever do it. One is we could maybe start with a higher expectation of healthy lunches across the country and set some standards, start high, you know, with a high bar of expectation, but we're a long ways from anything like that. And internationally, many of the churches I talk to and stuff sponsor families internationally and that kind of thing. Please don't stop that. I really talk to people about it's not an either or. You know, we need to work at all those levels. We need to find things to do that support children and food security at all levels. So don't, just because I work at REACH and we're a Regina-based, I'm very conscious that I need to know what's happening in the province, and I need to know what's happening in Canada, and I need to know what's happening in the world. So it's important not to say, well, we're supporting this group now and not this group. No, we need to work at all those levels. You know, change can start anywhere, and we can have the ripple effect up and down. So I think that's where I'll stop. I don't. And questions?
You hear a lot on the media about national school lunch programs. I suppose it's mainly in the U.S., where they have these ridiculous arguments about whether ketchup is a vegetable, you know.
Yeah.
And the kids seem to uniformly reject the good meals. And I was wondering if you've given much thought to that. Mm-hmm. If you do have a national program or whatever, how do you... I mean, the kids just throw the good stuff away, it seems.
Well, yes and no. And I think anybody here followed Jamie Oliver and his battles with trying to change things in England. I think there's a harder time getting parents and school cooks to change than there is getting the children to change. And that's what we were talking about, why it's so important to work with those preschool kids, that because we expose them to healthy foods and what good eating is, and they will emulate that as they go. But Jamie Oliver's had a fair amount of success. The problem is when you have the ketchup there. If you don't have the ketchup there, that's it. But we've done, one of the things I didn't talk about is in the summertime, REACH, we don't make the lunches except in the summertime. All our lunch programs are, they're through the partners that we work with. But in the summertime, because there is no school programs, we partner with the City of Regina and actually with a couple of churches. and the YMCA camps, and there's a few things that we're involved in. And we actually make the lunches, and we deliver those lunches to that site. We have a lunch provider who is the Heritage Community Association. They make the lunches, but we give them the menu, we buy the food, and we very healthy lunches, and the kids eat those lunches because that's what they get. There's no, those other things aren't there, and they are getting eaten. So they will, but it's, you have to have a lot of people on board to do that. And I think if we had a national lunch program at some day, and I mean, this is really pie in the sky. We're a long ways from it. Most of our schools don't even have kitchens, our elementary schools. So, I mean, there's so much that would have to be done to be even able to do it. But we would just have to set those standards, and which we might be able to do because we don't have one night. Now, sometimes it's harder to change a system that's already operating a certain way than if you could start clean. And in most cases, you're starting pretty clean if we had a national program. But it's, yeah, you got to get to the kids early. But parents are just as bad. They had to ban, in when they started to make some of the changes in England, they actually had to ban kids bringing lunches to school. Everybody had to be a part of it. And once that started, they were able to, in some areas, really change it. But the person they had to get on the change the most was what they called the lunch ladies, the ladies that made the lunches, because they were convinced the kids wouldn't eat those things. And they will at first throw them away because it's so foreign, and they had to work with the parents because the parents, that's what they thought was okay. So, you know, you kind of have to work them all together. I sit on two national committees, so, you know, that's my passion there too.
You're welcome.
So you feel it's not a matter that our planet doesn't produce enough food. It's a matter of distribution, education.
Yeah.
And I find it rather amazing, like areas in Calgary where they do have encouraged people to plant part of their front lawns into gardens, and they're trying to get chickens in the backyard if they can. But we grew up in the dirty 30s. We worked not on welfare. We didn't have any money, but we never were hungry.
Yep, totally. Now, you know, again, it's easy to judge people's lives. Like many of the low-income people that we're working with, they don't even live in a place where they could have a garden. And that's why community gardens are important. But nowadays, I don't know how many people here have a garden. It's not cheap. You know, it's not cheap. Seeds aren't cheap, and water's not cheap. And so, you know, we got to find ways to break down those barriers also and to help support that. But again, you know, some of the schools now are incorporating gardens. They're partnering with the community association, and they've got a garden, you know, and so exposing the kids to the gardens and how important that is. And exactly, you know, there's all of those things.
This will have to be our last question, but I hope you can stay a little while.
Oh, yeah.
There'll be people wanting to talk to you.
I got a household of sick people. I don't need to go back to them yet.
I think what you're doing is fantastic. And I was sort of marginally involved years ago with trying to get cooking programs and so forth involved. Mm-hmm. And now I was talking to someone last night who is involved with the redesign of the new Connaught School.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I hope you're going to have a rooftop garden. And it should be a greenhouse because we live in a wintry place.
Yeah.
And so what do you do all winter? You have to rely on food from outside. So one thing is about design of schools.
Yes.
And greenhouses. And then the other thing I was thinking about is First Nations have lots of land.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe there'd be some way of, maybe it's already happening. I buy eggs from a First Nations woman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she has a little chicken farm, and they're beautiful eggs. None of them have ever cracked. And, you know, so it'd be nice to support local producers too. I mean, not just First Nations, but perhaps teaching First Nations to have, you know, their own gardens, their own greenhouses.
Yeah. There is some, I don't guess I don't need that. Yeah, there is some of that happening.
Yes.
I don't know how much around here, but there's a lot more in the north happening. but design of schools, the North Central Shared Facility, and I can't say the, because it has the name now, they have a name, so that's the new Scott Collegiate. It does have in the plans a rooftop garden, and it does long-term have a plan for a greenhouse. So those definitely are built into that. Now, at what stage those happen, I don't know, but very much they're very, very aware of that for that. And I know in the north on some of the First Nations reserves there are greenhouses now. So there is, you know, it's slow. Unfortunately, some of the reserves don't have very good land. Like, they can't grow, you know, they can grow some things, but yeah, the soil is not the greatest. But where they can, it's starting slowly.
Well, my goodness, thank you very much. I think what I get from this is that we need one another, and we need to help one another. Thank you very much. And Dana, we would like to give you this to reach you on behalf of Unitarian Fellowship.
Thank you very much.